Hi, this is Daniel Chalkett.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, a non-zero amount of dollars. This week's show is sponsored by Digimarc and Linode. Well, Manton, 2 weeks ago today, to the day, you got to congratulate me in my post-release come-down fury. And now today I get to do the same for you because you have officially opened micro.blog to the masses.
Yep.
You have a limit in place. Is it still 100 new users per day?
Yeah. So the masses, if they can fit into 100. Is it masses if it's only 100 people?
Yeah. But, you know, hey, we talked about this last week, I think. I think last week your goal now should be to try to get that 100-person limit met every day, right? Like, you want that to be, you know, that's your goal, I think,
right?
Is get people, get that to be a problem for people if it's not already. But yeah, it's exciting news. And now, you know, you can tell anybody who wants to be part of micro.blog, they just have to wait until midnight to have the best chance. Is that the trick?
Yeah. And I mean, right now it's still a fairly slow stream of the masses. So it's not, I don't think it's difficult. It's GMT, I think. I just picked a date and I don't think I did anything special with time zones. I mean, I know I didn't. So it's GMT. I don't know what that comes out to. Mm-hmm. I thought about making it like central time for Austin or something, but it doesn't really matter that much. If you get an error message, you just try back and it shouldn't be a huge problem. It'll definitely hit 100 these next few days, I think. I opened it yesterday and it was already getting close to the end of the day, I think. So it actually, there were fewer than 100 people by a handful, but I expect that it shouldn't have any trouble having 100 people join. And, you know, I haven't done any promotion yet. You know, as we talked about, I was kind of on the fence about whether to make a big deal about it. I did make a blog post trying to highlight that I did release a bunch of new stuff all at once. And people, that was mostly for existing users, and they were certainly excited. New icons in the apps, which was really fun. Brad Ellis, who helped you with the Mars Edit 4 icon, also did a brand new Mac icon for micro.blog and loved it so much. We put it on iOS too and on the web. And that was great. A lot of people liked that, wanted to make a big deal about that. But I haven't done a lot of promotion outside of a blog post. I plan to, but it's not quite there yet. So right now it's mostly people joining because they heard about it through one of my blog posts or like, you know, you tweeting about it or someone else tweeting about it. And so I think it'll be a fairly slow stream of people coming in, but people will be coming in. And yeah, like I just looked a few minutes ago and I mean, probably we'll hit the limit fairly soon each day, but I'll just kind of expand that as it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense for you to have the limit just to sort of protect yourself against the, great problem to have, but possibly service destroying problem of like, you know, Howard Stern suggesting that people sign up for it or something like that. It's like
I think it just makes things easier, and like there are issues too. Like, you know, there are bugs that I just haven't quite fixed. You know, there was an issue with rate limiting this morning. Actually, I had worked on some rate limiting mostly to stop people from abusing the API. So I want it to be as open as possible, but I also do not want you to like slam the API endpoints with like thousands of requests, you know, per second or minute or whatever. And so I wanted some limits in place. There was a bug with that actually the limits were incorrectly calculated. And so some people hit a rate limit today just using like the Mac app. That's unfortunate. And so like those kind of issues with a small user base, I can work through and people can forgive me. Whereas if there are thousands and thousands of people, then it becomes, you know, small problems like that. And that's not really a small problem, but it's fairly easily fixed problem. Issues like that just kind of explode if there's a lot of new people hitting it at once.
So let me just briefly review your business model for micro.blog. If you get 100 new signups today, that makes you $0. is that correct? Unless they choose to add a paid plan. Is that the deal?
That's the deal. It's freemium. So yeah. I could have 100 people join and pay me nothing. I haven't done a lot of calculations on this, but I think it's going to work out to be a non-zero amount of dollars. I think it'll settle out to, I think, a fairly classic, most people don't pay, some percentage of people start a trial, and then some percent of people pay either right away or when their 10-day trial is up, they pay.
Yeah.
And so yesterday, you know, some people signed up and didn't pay. Most people didn't, but some people did. Some people right away registered and created, pay me $5, created a new microblog. And if they're happy, they will continue to pay, once a month because it's a subscription. So far, I haven't seen anything that makes me panic. But of course, there's always room for improvement in like how we market it, how we just sell the paid aspects on the website, making it more clear, making it easier, making it just more obvious that, this is actually, you do want me to host your blog for you because it'll make things easier for you.
Yeah. So I think, if you had like 100 new users coming in a day, that's a great goal to be able to, it seems like if you had say like 5 new paying customers a day, you'd be pretty stoked right now. Is that?
Yeah. 5%. Seems like a reasonable, like in the ballpark of a good number of people. I mean, obviously more would be greater, but I think that would be a reasonable number.
Cool. Well, this is good. Do you feel any of the similar feelings to, I know you've been doing this more gradually than I did. So, I reported 2 weeks ago this sort of like feeling of relief and like weight off my shoulders. For you, it's probably not exactly the same, but does this feel like a transition? Does it feel like, you were in sort of like pre-release mode and now you're in post-release mode?
I still feel like I'm in the middle of not quite post-release still. Like when I announced the new stuff, I was really excited because I had been working on some new features. Usually when I work on a feature and I test it and everything's good, I just like release it like right away, just kind of making things better, especially as it's kind of in that beta period with Kickstarter backers. And even later when it's kind of like not available to everyone, I just want to make the platform better as fast as I can. And so lately I've been kind of holding those changes and I bundled a few together and I did the new icons and I did new versions of the web, iOS and Mac apps, and I put them all out on the same day when I opened it to the public. And I think that was good. It felt like a real major improvement all at once.
Mm-hmm.
But I still didn't have that feeling of like, now I'm done. Now I can breathe a sigh of relief. I think actually some of my users felt that more than I did because I noticed a lot of posts and tweets, saying, oh, it's available to everyone now, you should go join. And that was great. But yeah, I think I still feel like there's unfinished work. I still feel like there's a lot to do before it's really complete and like where it's at the point that I can do even more marketing and I can kind of take a break from some of the scrambling and the bug fixing.
Yeah. Well, I guess even though I felt a sense of relief, I've also been scrambling these past 2 weeks to, release bug fix updates. And there is that sense, especially when you do get some more attention, like my thinking went immediately from, oh, thank God I'm done with this, to, oh, now everyone's looking at this and now I need to really fix these things that are, impeding people having a good take on the app. So you're right. I mean, it's never done. I think we just have to, of course, remind ourselves that even though it's never done, we do all these little milestones do add up to, there are things we wanted to do and getting them done feels good. So, and like you said, these collection of things that you've saved up, the release yesterday, the update for you of micro.blog. I mean, just think back now to how far you've come since, less than a year ago, you put the Kickstarter up and It was a completely different product then. There was no Mac app. The iOS app, I think, didn't exist, or you hadn't publicly released it on like day one.
Yeah, for a little while, it was. I had it as a beta for test flight users, and so I invited like all the Kickstarter backers to test flight, which was fine, but it was certainly wasn't done. It wasn't in the App Store. It was kind of a mess.
Yeah.
No, you're right. It's so much has been done. Like, I actually was reminded of this when I saw a tweet from a user who backed it on Kickstarter, and he was replying to someone else, and he said something like, yeah, you know, MicroDotBlog's not for me. I don't really understand it, or something like that. And I kind of like, I was trying to like get into like, okay, what's behind that? And it turned out he had backed on Kickstarter, but yeah, he hadn't looked at it in 6 months. And like 6 months ago, it was not a completely different product. I mean, the premise and the concept and like a lot of, you know, most of the code, I guess, was the same, but it is so much better now that it's like, if you judge it by what it looked like 6 months ago, that's like judging Mars at 1 and thinking about Mars at 4. It's completely, completely changed. And I have no doubt there's so much I still want to do that, you know, in 6 months from now, I'll feel the same way. It's looking back, it's like, yes, this, you know, quote unquote public launch was still not nearly as good as the product will be 6 months from now, a year from now. But especially in that early, you know, that early part of when you have a brand new product and you're getting to 1.0 or getting from 1.0 to 2.0, which is kind of what this feels like for me, the product changes so quickly. It's just so much better than it was earlier in the year.
And I think it's worth reminding ourselves that, you know, because I don't know if you suffer from this as much as I do, Manton, but I can get into a little mind thinking rut where I think, oh, well, Mars Edit 4, you know, still lacks this. It still is not, you know, satisfying this market segment. It's still XYZ, whatever. I still don't have an iOS app.
Mm-hmm.
But when I try to remind myself, and this, you know, this is a good time for you to remind yourself of it too, if it helps, is just how much further along towards those ideals we are, because we've, you know, just been trudging along. And it's like, you've had this idea for MicroBlog for years now, and whatever your vision of it being, I know it's shifted a little bit over the years, but like, you know, however many years ago it was that you first started thinking about this, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have this baseline work to start with. And so it's like, I think it can be really helpful for those of us who have like pursued something, even if we are not, you know, for one thing, it's easy to get like to stop seeing the special value of things we make, I think, after we get used to them and we've made them. And it's, so you just kind of think like, oh, well, it's just this microblogging service I made, and, or it's just this, you know, Mac app that connects to all these different blogs. But it's like, I try to keep reminding myself or try to like get a new vision for what you want a product to be. And then to be excited about the fact that what you're working with, what you're starting with is not from scratch, right? Like, you get to say, like, imagine somebody out there who, or like, imagine you 4 years ago having this vision for micro.blog, and then somebody hands you micro.blog as it is today.
Yeah.
You'd be like, what? Woo-hoo, oh, this is awesome.
Head start.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I just think that that's like, in my worst, like, sort of like, I'm pretty optimistic right now because I've just shipped, but like, at my worst, like, few months ago when I'm just like, oh, I just got to get this done, it can be really easy to almost just want to like throw my hands up and just say, you know what, this is not for me. And I have a problem where I kind of often look at what needs to be done as almost like as if it needs to be done from scratch. And I have to remind myself like, oh, here are these privileges I have. I, you know, have a huge source base of code that already tackles tons of problems that anybody who wants to do this kind of app would have to tackle. You know, I have like all of this like knowledge of the product space that you would have to be submersed in the market to understand. And I don't know why I'm talking this up so much, just to say like, it's easy to think of like what we're working on today as the end point, but it's actually just like the new foundation for what, you know, a year from now, we're going to look back again and, you know, hopefully you'll be saying, oh my gosh, micro.blog December 2017 was just a little baby of a site, mm-hmm. you know? And it's only because you have this like determination to keep building this. And because now you have this foundation to build upon that you can look forward to something even more, you know?
Yeah.
And I know you already want it to be more than it is, but this is a cool foundation to have.
Thanks. And I do feel that it's like, it's an interesting product to work on because it's the first thing in a long time that I've really only wanted to work on, you know, and for basically my whole career, I've had either, you know, a regular job where I'm working on a couple projects and then maybe a product on the side or maybe a couple products on the side. And with Riverfold Software, you know, I had at some point, you know, four or five different products that I was kind of juggling and I liked that. And this is the first time where I can see this just being it. This is all I want to work on. And what comes with that are kind of two things. One, the ambition and like the scope of how, what I think it could be in a year, 2 years, but also kind of in a way, like the patience to be content with getting there one step at a time. I'm super impatient with some things. And like I said, when I finish a feature, I want to just like release it to customers right away. And it's hard to like hold back and like wait a week or a month. But at the same time with this, I feel kind of patient and like this will work out just like one step at a time. I can't get from nothing to this incredible platform like overnight. It will take a series of steps. And as long as each step is mostly in the right the right path, then I'll get there. It's just kind of an interesting, it's a little bit different than other projects I've worked on in the past. And I think part of that is, yeah, just the scope, just because it could be quite big. And there's so many things that come along with anything that resembles a platform or social network or mm-hmm. publishing platform or anything. There's so many things that come along with it. And it's a little daunting, but I feel like we'll get there. I'm really optimistic, I guess.
Well, here's what one of the things, when you say it could get quite big, I love that vision because that's one of the things that kind of like, There's an element of being an indie developer, you know, in an entrepreneurial way. There's an element of, for me, kind of like this, like almost gambling style. Like, you know, it could be, hey, big money, right. You roll the dice. It could be I make $100. It could be I make $1 million. And that aspect of it, obviously, it can be frustrating when you're making $100. But you know, I think something like micro.blog has the there's a couple different like plateaus for micro.blog. Like, I imagine it, you know, it's not making the money that you think, like it, whatever money it's making today, it probably, if it just kept making that amount of money for the rest of your career, that would not be like sustainable.
Right.
There's some point where there will be a plateau where, you know, one of the cool things about this service is it doesn't need to be, and because you're starting it as an indie, it doesn't need to be massive to be valuable and profitable. So like it'll reach a point where, you know, because it's just serving, it's filling a specific need that its users want to have filled. And that need is not as dependent as other social networks on massive scale. Like, you know, something like Twitter needs to be massive for it to be valuable to its users. Something like Facebook, same thing.
Yep.
And micro.blog is, in the way that it is a self, you know, it's a personal hosting service on top of its social features. I could see you getting to this one point where there's a plateau of, oh, you are now making a healthy annual, you know, comparable to a salary income from this, you know, sustaining base of users. And that will be like one level. And then, you know, if you're lucky, you'll go like, oh, I got to another plateau, which is like, I'm making, you know, whatever, enough money that I want to hire people to help with this, or I just want to get rich or whatever. maybe both. But I like that about this, that it's not like a Hail Mary type, you know, shoot the moon product, like so many, for instance, venture capital products are. Like, I think this can be a sustainable, you know, kind of like these services that, what's it called? WP Engine for hosting WordPress blogs. Like, that easily could have been a sustainable one-person indie venture that probably would have made the founder healthy income. And it just it met that plateau, but then it went to the next level.
Right.
And it's like clearly hugely, I mean, I'm imagining it's a hugely profitable enterprise that sustains a lot of people's incomes.
Yeah, I think they have hundreds of employees.
Yeah.
And another example that's similar is something like Squarespace. Just last week, Squarespace announced they raised like $200 million. You know, their valuation is 1 point something billion. And that's a huge company. That's tons of money, right? Well, I mean, just a few days ago, I got, you know, an email from someone who wants to move from Squarespace to micro.blog, right? So I'm not saying I can just like slowly like carve away like some large percentage of Squarespace customers, but there is huge overlap in the hosting that I'm doing and these million-dollar companies, right? So, or billion-dollar companies in some cases. So that gives me a lot of confidence because, like you said, I don't need to have hundreds of employees. I don't need to be huge like that. But just the fact that there is a path to that kind of sustainable revenue, you know, and it's going to take work to get there. I mean, it's like not, there's no guaranteed, you know, success. There's no guarantee that people aren't going to cancel, that I'm going to actually lose revenue next month compared to this month. But there's a kind of a clear business model there that has been proven many times. And hopefully I'll be lucky enough to be able to grow this and to make it even bigger than it is now. And also I would love to be in a position, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I'd love to be in a position where I can make those choices of like, no, we don't need to be that big. Like, we're not going crazy here. We can keep it small and have a nice team and build something that's special and that, you know, is valuable to people.
Yeah. All right, Manson. Well, I think it's, it's 11 a.m. here, so I'm not going to raise a drink to toast you, but I will toast you with my coffee. And congratulations, and I'm looking forward to seeing how things go. I'm not going to ask you about the microblogging book because I don't want to put you into a cold sweat.
Yeah. Dave, I was just getting excited about and optimistic about everything. You got to bring that up. Doom and gloom. The book's not ready.
Oh, that, you know, that, speaking of like the relief of like weight off your shoulders transition, that's an example of a product when you finish and ship it. I'm sure you will have that feeling for.
Yes. Yes. That'll be a really good day.
Yeah. All right. Our first sponsor today is Digimarc. With the Digimarc Discover SDK, apps get the best mobile scanner of the most common traditional 1D barcodes. It's lightning fast, super reliable, and inexpensive. App users experience incredible scanning performance regardless of varying distances, perspectives, blur, glare, and challenging barcodes. No more fumbling or frustration. In addition to scanning the most common traditional 1D barcodes, as well as QR codes, the Digimarc Discover mobile SDK also future-proofs apps with the exclusive capability to scan Digimarc barcodes. These are imperceptible codes used in product packaging, print, and audio media for delivering digital product information and content. So it's one software kit with unlimited possibilities. Check out digimarc.com/mobile SDK for more information. Thanks to Digimarc for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, you know, they talk in this about regular barcodes, but also these like imperceptible special barcodes that can be kind of hidden on something, a poster, a package, whatever. And They have a neat video on their website. This is new. I hadn't seen this before, where they use just one example, which is like a frozen box of food or something that you get at a grocery store, like a lunch that you microwave. And you know, normally on these kind of things in the grocery store, everything has like a UPC barcode. Like in the corner somewhere, there's this little, you know, these little black lines and numbers. And when you go to checkout, they scan it and beep, you know, you get it's $2 or whatever. And of course, you know, we've all been to the grocery store and they try to scan something that doesn't work. They have to like flip it over again, or, you know, for frozen stuff, maybe there's frosted, you know, ice on it or something. Anyway, sometimes it doesn't work. And the example I like a lot is because they show that instead of that little corner of the box with the UPC code, the whole box is a barcode essentially, because they've built some kind of pattern into the packaging so you can scan it anywhere. And to the user looking at it, it doesn't look like there's a barcode, but there is. And you can do this again with like posters, products, other kinds of things. And so if scanners were smarter, there would be less issue because they could scan anywhere in the box. And you might think, well, that doesn't apply to me. But it does, because if you use the mobile SDK that they have, you can have this functionality in your own iOS product using the camera on the iPhone. This is a neat thing. It's not something that everybody needs, but if you have ever needed to scan something, maybe this will spark an idea in your next product or your product for a client, that this kind of technology really could open up some interesting possibilities to be able to scan products, posters, and other things in the real world and have some information in them. So thanks so much to Digimarc for sponsoring the show. All right, Daniel. Well, as we're recording, that's big news, actually. Bloomberg, Mark Gurman just posted a big scoop, really, if this is true, that Apple plans to combine iPhone, iPad, and Mac apps to create one user experience. That's the kind of title. And then he goes through in some more detail, and then he kind of adds some things and elaborates. And we don't know exactly what this means, but the sense of it is at WWDC this year, Apple will probably allow some way to take iOS apps and put them on the Mac. And the way I read this is UIKit is coming to the Mac. That's kind of how I read it. Or the UX kit that Apple has a private framework for, something like that.
Right.
I don't read this as one operating system for both platforms, or you take an iOS app from the App Store and it just like magically runs on the Mac without recompiling. I don't think they're going to go crazy like that. But to me, this says shared framework. This like an easier way to take an iOS app with minimal or no changes and bring it over to the Mac. Like, is that your reading? What do you think about this?
Yeah, well, I saw the headline, of course. It says Apple said to combine iPhone, iPad, mm-hmm. and Mac apps.
Yeah.
And that sounds a lot more ambitious than I think your take on it is probably right, that it's and Gurman goes into it and basically verifies that is the take, that it's not about combining them per se necessarily. It's about bringing iOS stuff to the Mac. And this has been a challenge that people have been trying to overcome on one way or another for years. I'm reminded of the Chameleon project, mm-hmm. which the Icon Factory used years ago to port. I think it was like they had done Twitterific for the Mac, and then they did it for iPhone, and then they brought it back to the Mac through this. I can't remember it exactly, I guess.
That's right. But they used to have a completely separate Mac and iOS code base, and then they basically ported parts of UIKit to the Mac so they could build a new version of Mac Twitterific easier. That worked okay, but then Chameleon fell behind and it wasn't updated and it was out of date with the iOS code they needed. And so nothing happened for a while. And then they ended up just building a brand new Mac app from scratch. And Chameleon is just kind of on the sidelines. Yeah. I don't think anyone uses it much.
So I think, you know, they must have run into some of the challenges that this kind of approach brings. Obviously, if Apple does it, it's likely to be, you know, more, you know, like I said, I don't really see Mac and iOS frameworks combining per se. Like I have a hard time imagining that whatever this project is, that it means that AppKit is going away, for example. Mm-hmm. Like I can see the merit in supporting a bunch of iOS apps being sort of adapted to run on the Mac. And an app like Twitterific was a pretty good example of something I think that is well suited to having a less conventional Mac UI, because it's kind of like one of these heads-up display. You know, mm-hmm. it lends itself well to a sort of heads-up display type, you know, like micro.blog mm-hmm. on the Mac.
Single window, and you have a lot of things yeah. in the app that feel like UIKit navigation controllers,
right.
where you're sliding things back and forth. And that's something that iOS is good at because it needs to be, and the Mac is less good at in terms of how yeah. Kit thinks about the world.
Now, to be fair, you know, iOS apps have shifted over the years steadily towards being kind of like desktop apps. And, mm-hmm. you know, the iPad, I think, has driven that. You look at something like iPad, Apple's, you know, own version of Mail for the iPad maps pretty well to the Mac version yeah. of Mail. Yeah. So, like, I could see Marsedit, for example, sharing that sort of, you know, traditional multi-pane layout. I could see, you know, for instance, an iPad version of Marsedit sort of fitting that. It's a little bit less clear how well things would adapt that are like iPhone only to start with. Or like, you know, you take something like, if you just adapt like an iPhone version of some app to the Mac, I just don't see it working well. So I think at the end of the day, like whatever technology this provides to developers, there's going to be, as always, this like huge design issue. Like, how do you make this actually work well? And, you know, it's funny, like you and I, Manton, before we started recording this show, were sort of griping about the Skype app we use to chat with each other. And they had a major update, and it looks like somebody came in with like Silverlight from 2008 yeah, or something. Right. And I'm like, is this thing running in Flash? I don't know. Yeah. And it's a really horrible. It's one of these things. Like, it's a great example of being really. I think I wouldn't say it's a great visual design because it has these, to my eye, kind of ugly like gradients and stuff. But it is it's a passable. It's a designed visual design, but it is not a designed user experience, I think.
It's certainly way out of place on the Mac. I hate to be too critical of apps, and it's like real people worked on this, and but like there's yeah. so many problems, and it's clearly a cross-platform something or other. Yeah. You know, like closed boxes are in the wrong place. The preferences window looks like it's running on some Flash thing on iOS. Like it's completely out of place, and depending on what this story means, I mean, we could get some Mac apps that look like this.
Yeah. Well, and we already have some. Like, we have Skype. So it's to some extent, Apple, you know, giving developers the tools to make poor adaptations of iOS apps, to some extent, that doesn't really, it doesn't hurt the platform, I guess. I guess the way that it hurts the platform is the extent to which it makes it easier. You know, like Skype did this because they have a major investment and they haven't, you know, they want to, whatever reasons they have, it's not as easy for every developer on iOS to just say, oh yeah, I'm going to make a fully cross-platform version of my app as well. So there is the risk that whatever Apple provides will make for a greater abundance of poorly designed Mac experiences, but I can also see the argument that, hey, you know, a poorly designed solution that runs on the Mac is still a solution. And, you know, the fact is we're using Skype because it's the best solution we found. And if we didn't have this version of Skype and there was a Skype version on iOS and Apple came out with something that said, good news, just pop this onto the Mac and you can now have a Skype version on the Mac, I would say, hey, that's a win for us.
Mm-hmm.
So the funny thing is, here's what I find a little bit. I mean, I guess I'm intrigued by the possibility that this project will be released. And I think clearly some level of interoperation between the frameworks would be welcome. The thing that makes me a little bit skeptical is like, how much is Apple holding out? Because as far as I know, there's little silly things like, you still can't, you still have NS color on the Mac and UI color on iOS. Is that true?
That's true.
As far as you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's definitely true.
It kind of UI makes image, me wonder, like,
I mean, there's like at least 10 right. different examples of things that are almost identical, but not identical enough to compile.
Yeah. And it's that stuff, it seems like if Apple were moving towards a unification, it seems like we would have seen more gradual unification of stuff like that. But maybe they're just holding out and planning to, mm-hmm. you know, if they drop this next WWDC and it includes, you know, the ability to basically adapt an iOS app, but it also includes like bridging for all those types. I'll be pretty happy with that because I think I would continue working on my stuff significantly differently for Mac and iOS, but I already have a bunch of junk in my source base that's like basically cobbling those types together. So, and I bet a lot of folks who work on both platforms do the same. So if this includes improvements in that area, I think it'll be a big win even for developers who aren't going to just like copy over an iOS version of the app to the Mac.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And if you look at UXKit, which is Apple's private framework that they use in Photos. So Photos, you know, they basically threw out all the iPhoto code, right? They built Photos for iOS, iPhone and iPad, and then they moved it to the Mac with UXKit. But if you look at it, Photos, it looks like a totally native, good Mac app. They use a lot of these foundation, like UXKit includes all of the stuff that you're talking about. It includes UX color, UX image, all these kind of cross-platform classes. But if you look at like Photos, the preferences window, that's all AppKit. Like it's not some weird hybrid thing like in Skype. Like it's just AppKit. It's a preferences window. There's radio right. buttons and right. stuff that don't even exist on the iPhone. So that's what I feel like Apple should do. They should use UXKit as an experiment and roll out something similar to everyone. And that'll mean some work. Like you won't be able to just take an iPhone app necessarily and recompile it. Like it might take a little bit of work to fill in some mm-hmm. of, I mean, the Mac menu bar, for example. I mean, there's things that you have to think about. And in Gurman's article, there's a few things that stick out as kind of strange, and I'm not sure I totally buy that interpretation. Here's one example. He says, starting as early as next year, software developers will be able to design a single application that works with a touchscreen or mouse and trackpad. And like that word design, like design a single application, like, mm-hmm. yeah, maybe. But like you're saying, like, there's still things about the platform that are different.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll see. I feel like that's the path they should take is a framework that is either exactly UIKit or UIKit inspired that will allow you to just much more easily build your app on both platforms where it's like, it's not a chore. It's not like I built the iOS version. They're like, oh my gosh, there's no way I have the time and resources to build the Mac app, which is what I was feeling with Micro.blog. You know, it's like,
right.
I almost didn't do a Mac version at all because it is a significant amount of work. The only way I was able to do it, honestly, is that there are a lot of portions of Micro.blog that use HTML and JavaScript. And I was able to basically have a lot of shared code between the platforms for that, from that aspect, even though the Mac app is UIKit and Objective-C and has a bunch of native controls. And it was just too daunting to build everything from scratch for both platforms just because I'm just one person. I'm also building the whole web platform as well. If I had a UIKit kind of solution that I could move my iOS app to the Mac app, I absolutely would have used that.
Mm-hmm. And I should, you know, point out that I'm not against cross-platform code where it makes sense. And Mars Edit is a great example of that considering the rich editor is completely implemented. Well, not completely, but it's substantially implemented in HTML and JavaScript. So
right.
I can see how they clearly are two separate questions, like the design and the technology that helps you implement the design. I guess it's going to be fascinating to see. I was looking at an app bundle. I went and looked at a Photos app bundle when you were talking about it. Mm-hmm. And because I wanted to grep and see if I could find any matches for Marzipan, which is code name for this. I just thought that would be funny if somebody had accidentally left something in there or whatever. And I didn't find anything. But, you know, looking at an app bundle on the Mac, I could see, you know, there's kind of this like this funny like legacy thing that in an app bundle on the Mac, in contrast to iOS, you have like contents, and then there's like these subfolders for like the actual binary on the Mac goes into a subfolder called macOS. And it's kind of funny because it's like, well, this on the Mac, this is there's only ever been one subfolder, and it's called macOS, mm-hmm. and that's where the binary goes. But I think that sort of goes back to Next transition. And it's funny looking at this because, you know, the the way I structure my code base, a lot of my internal frameworks are cross-platform. Like, you know, I have a framework called RS Web Publishing, which, you know, incorporates all of my API support for blogging systems. And I could picture an app in the future that has a bunch of common frameworks. It's an app bundle that has a bunch of common frameworks and then has this macOS folder where my Mac executable goes, and then maybe has an iOS folder where my iOS executable goes. And it doesn't have to be literally the same main app executable. Like, I think that's one of the things that, you know, there's some balance where you have some customized, unique code for each platform, and you have some shared code, and some of it's obviously shareable. All, you know, like all foundation is shareable. But I can see there being some merit in sort of staking out some ground. Like, you still have to write something custom for each platform. I could see that maybe we'll end up with actually having a reason for that app bundle having a little macOS differentiator from something else. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting that some of the article, I'm just kind of scanning some of the headlines, and some people are running with the idea of using the word run, like Marzipan will let iOS apps run on a Mac, which again, I just don't see that. But some people's headlines of this say that, and that's more like you're getting into like it looks like the iOS simulator on your Mac. And right. I mean, maybe Apple will do that. I will be surprised if they do that, but they might. They might do it.
I don't see it's. It doesn't seem like an Apple thing to do. But you know, who knows? They've been changing a lot over the past many years. It's one of those things that sounds like, wouldn't that be handy? Yes, it would be handy, but Apple doesn't do things just to be handy. Like, you know, they don't really provide like lots of bells and whistles just to like make something possible. They like to make it a designed experience. So I have to imagine that whatever Marzipan is, it goes to some lengths to either make it easier for developers to make smart design choices, or you know, there's ways that it could, Marzipan could be like a completely different interpretation of the UI elements of a Zib, you know, for example. You could have like a UI, you could have all the UI buttons on, in a way, like the way iOS has been moving towards having all these different size classes and such. You could imagine doing a fairly good job of reinterpreting the UI of some views in a more like Mac style. And it would be interesting to see if you took something like the iOS version of Mail, like I was saying, for iPad, and how much can you adapt it to look like and behave like a Mac app just by reinterpreting the UI elements and, you know, applying Mac sort of mechanics to them.
Yeah, I think a lot of those apps could be moved over fairly easily. You have the menu bar and extra windows and things to deal with in maybe an app kit specific way, but like that main window is kind of the same on both platforms, and all that code for the most part could be shared. And now that we have drag and drop on the iPad and stuff like that, that could just transfer over. The iOS drag and drop API is really nice. It's not the same as AppKit, but it's great. Like, I have no complaints with it. I think you could just completely move that over to the Mac without any issues. There's a part in this article on Bloomberg that at the end, it feels like it kind of starts going into just like random speculation. And that's why I think we can get tripped up sometimes with these news stories, because there's some truth to this, whether they ship it or not, and what it looks like, we have no idea, but there's definitely something here. But to make an article, they have to add extra stuff. And then the part that I feel like really goes off the rails here is at the end, he says, that would make it easier to create a single operating system for all Apple gadgets, something Microsoft has already done with its desktop, laptop, and Surface tablets. And that, to me, there's no basis for that whatsoever in the story. Going from being able to run iOS apps on the Mac to it's going to be a unified operating system, that's a huge stretch, and I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, and it does. It presumes that Apple would reap some other benefit from doing that, and I don't think it's been clear to anybody that Apple would actually benefit from a single operating system. I mean, I guess it would mean, you know, one operating system doesn't get left behind, so to speak. But I mean, I've had a bad track record this year, you know, making guesses about Apple's actions. You know, I didn't think Face ID was going to happen, and for example, and so I'm a little bit hesitant to make lots of speculative guesses. But I would just like, I agree with you that if people are going to make claims like this, I would like them to draw a clear picture for exactly why Apple would be motivated to do that. It's like this sort of presupposes that that's what Apple has been wanting to do all along, is to copy Microsoft's approach and to go to a single OS, you know, strategy. And I just don't think that, I think it's way more likely that Apple's kind of like very satisfied with the fact that they've kept the OSs separate.
Yeah, I think they are. And, you know, to his credit in this article, he does quote Tim Cook after that saying, you can't combine these things. So last question for you to wrap this up, Daniel. Let's say there is a new framework that's based on UIKit.
Yeah.
But it's new and it's cross-platform and it adds a lot of AppKit things that you need, and then it brings over the iOS things you need. It's designed for people that only know iOS, but it's a new framework that you could really build a Mac and iOS app from, and it'd be a great app on both platforms. Will it be Swift only?
I wonder where he's going with this.
Swift only. Okay. What do you think?
Oh, boy.
And I asked that question.
That's interesting. Yeah.
As an Objective-C person. Like, you joked yesterday that the Microdot blog Mac app must be all Objective-C because it's only like a 3 megabyte download, which is true. So I still love Objective-C, but could this be it? Could this be where Swift gets its real advantage, like a new UI framework that is just really leaving the past behind?
It feels like it's too soon to me. I feel like Apple has been so busy, I assume, just working on, you know, I mean, obviously people at Apple have been thinking at least, if not working on, you know, how... Given the embrace of Swift at Apple, they have to be thinking about how they're going to adapt in the long run to Swift-only versions of things that right now are like dynamically dispatched on AppKit and UIKit. I guess I don't see this particular, from what we've heard about this, I don't see this as being like a place to make that leap. Like, if the headline were more true, Apple plans combined iPhone, iPad, and Mac apps, that's where I would envision maybe them, like, you know, even though I don't think there's an obvious advantage to having one UI framework for both platforms, I could see if Apple had gone down the path of saying, like, okay, let's completely rethink UIKit and completely rethink AppKit and think about it all in a Swift-based mindset. I can see that might be where they say, oh, you know what? Even though it wasn't a priority for us to combine these platforms, we actually can for some reason. You know, we came up with this insight and it makes sense. I could see that being a place where they say Swift only. I think as it stands now, from everything I've been able to tell, you know, Swift is not even ABI, you know, lockdown ABI yet. You still can't ship Swift apps without bundling every Swift runtime library with the app. So I would be surprised if, from where we're at right now, where we were, you know, last WWDC, if we go within the next 6 months to, hey, there's this new Swift-only framework you can use for both platforms. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel quite ready to me yet, but yeah. I would love to be proven wrong. I mean,
I would hate you to be proven wrong. Maybe.
Well, I don't think AppKit's going away. So, you know, this is going to, if whatever this brings to the table, I don't think AppKit is going away for years and years and years. So it's got like a similar longevity in store for it to, I guess, what Objective-C has in store for it, which I think is years. Probably, you know, similar to how Carbon took a long, long time to actually go away, and there's still vestiges of it in the system. So I don't know. It's interesting. I think that whatever ambitious thing this could be, that the people who are working on it probably don't want the added difficulty of also trying to come up with a completely new Swift-based UI, sort mm-hmm. of like, you know, responder chain, whatever type solution.
Yeah.
I'll be very curious to see if I'm wrong about that, but I think as a practicality, it's probably going to still use UIKit and AppKit style, you know, messaging, Objective-C style messaging. And for that reason, it would be a purely political thing if they said, okay, you have to use this from Swift only. And I don't think they'd do that. I think they'd say, hey, this is for everybody who, you know, all of our developers who have apps on iOS, here's a way to more easily adapt them to the Mac.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, we'll see what they roll out. There'll be a lot of speculation in the meantime, but it feels like this is, you know, WWDC. This is an announcement for WWDC. We're not going to know anything for 6 months. And that's fine. We'll see. Yep. But in the meantime, well, there's good APIs we can use to build things.
Sounds like a good excuse for me to put off Mars Edit for iOS for at least another year.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting because it's definitely targeted at iOS people moving to the Mac. And of course, you're the opposite. And right. So if it's what we think it probably should be, it will help you move to iOS because you can have more shared yeah. code. But it doesn't help you in the same way that it helps a iOS-only blogging product move to the Mac. It helps them That's a right. lot more than it helps you.
Right. I might get some new competition.
Maybe.
Okay. Our second sponsor this week is Linode. If you need a Linux box to host a website, a private Git repository, or maybe to serve as the backend for your iOS app, consider Linode Cloud Hosting. With Linode, you can get a server running in under a minute. They've been doing infrastructure as a service since 2003, and their plans start at the 1 gigabyte level for only $5 a month. Linode's 10 global data centers are equipped with industry-leading data center-grade SSDs, and their plans range from that low $5 a month plan up to higher memory plans starting at 16 gigabytes. All of this comes with the full control you expect with a VM, supporting Docker containers, encrypted disks, VPNs, etc. And with Linode, you get 24/7 friendly support even on holidays. They also have a special promo code. This promo code is great because it gets you a $20 credit, which is equivalent to 4 free months at that entry level. So when you go to linode.com/coreint, use the promo code coreint2017. That's coreint2017. Thank you so much to Linode for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, of course. I use Linode for micro.blog, and I'm happy to report that as I rolled it out to more users this week, and we'll continue to expand that, my servers have not crumbled or anything. You know, I have a handful of Linode instances, and they are performing great. I'm not a sysadmin. I need one at some point. I need someone to help me. But in the meantime, Linode just makes it really easy for anyone to spin up a new server. And one of the things that I think maybe is underappreciated about them is their documentation and the guides they have. And I think they've been updating this, you know, routinely. And there's actually some new stuff in there that I could benefit from reading. One of the things that you mentioned, Daniel, in reading that about Linode is the Docker container support. And I haven't done a lot with this, but one of my new servers on Linode uses Docker. And it's one of the servers I have as kind of like a photo storage server. And it uses Docker, and I'm happy with that. And I'm still getting started, but I'm looking forward to reading more, especially those guides on Linode that have specific tips for setting this kind of stuff up on Linode. And that's just going to be invaluable as I scale up to more, even more servers. So thanks so much to Linode for sponsoring the show. They've been a great supporter of our podcast in 2017. All right, Daniel. Well, we talked early in the show about some of the new stuff on micro.blog. And of course, you have not just taken a vacation after releasing Mars Edit 4. You've been working on bug fix updates and just being responsive to customers because you provide great support. We all know that. How is it going? I saw you just posted Mars Edit 4.04.
Yes. Yeah, I'm cruising right along here. It's only been 2 weeks, but I have... You know, I guess that makes four bug fix updates. Since I'm burning away my versions here, Manton, I'm going to have to get 4.1 done pretty soon.
So what happened? I'm looking at your blog and I see 4.02, 4.04. What happened to 4.03?
don't ask any questions about the man behind the curtain. Yeah, the funny thing was Mars Edit 4. I launched Mars Edit 4.0 on my site with all of the features and fixes that Mars Edit 4.0.1 on the Mac App Store had. And this is one of those consequences of trying to time a release, make sure you get approved, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, you know, you need a little lead time on... Mac App Store submissions. And of course I knew I needed to get approved. I needed to, you know, have it up on the site. I didn't want to come to Tuesday 2 weeks ago and say, you know, like the poor folks at Literature and Latte with Scrivener, they obviously had something happen where they announced their big release on their site and they said, and we unfortunately don't have it on the Mac App Store yet. And they ended up coming out on the Mac App Store. They got featured and everything, great for them. But that was kind of a bummer for them, I'm sure. So I got Mars Edit 4 into the App Store approved. As I was sort of gearing up to release, I noticed a few little issues needed to be fixed, and I fixed them immediately before releasing Mars Edit 4 to the public on my site. And so then I had this disparity where I'm like, oh, got to get this fixed in the App Store. So I submit 4.0.1 to the App Store. Kind of a funny thing, like they approved 4.0, no problem. And then 4.0.1 comes along, and they're like, we need a login to your service. Like, I just got a reviewer who I think didn't understand blogging. They're like, send us a password for your service. I'm like, no, this is not Netflix. This is an app, a general purpose app. Anyway, I had to, a little back and forth. It took a little longer than I expected to get that approved. I ended up making my first significant update to Mars Edit 4 and calling it 4.0.2 instead of having like this permanent discrepancy between the versions. And 4.0.2 shipped for both Mac App Store and my site simultaneously. And I was like, phew, that's awesome. Got that fixed out the door. Hopped on a bus to New York City. And then somebody sent me this funny little bug report. And it was so minor seeming. Even the person who reported it said, this is a minor thing. Don't worry too much about it. I just thought I'd mention it. And they said, look at this screenshot. Even though Mars Edit says I'm registered and I've paid for the, you know, the full unlock of the app, if I look in the about box, it still says evaluation copy. And I was like, huh, that's weird. I must have just messed something up with the way that about box gets set. And I started looking into it. I'm on the bus. This is like a 4 or 5 hour bus ride from Boston to New York. And I started getting a little bit of a cold sweat because I was like, oh, this doesn't look good. And I ended up confirming that even though this customer had paid, the app thought this customer was in a trial period. So everything was working perfectly. But come the end of the trial... which, you know, I was on the bus on Wednesday a week ago. The trial was going to expire for the earliest downloaders of Mars Edit 4 on the coming Tuesday. So I had 6 days in which I knew, after which I knew people who had paid for the app were going to nonetheless have the app stop working for them. And it would be so embarrassing because they'd be like, I'm a great supporter of software. I paid $50 or I paid $25 for an upgrade. And now I'm going to go publish my blog post and it's going to say, please purchase Mars Edit. I was like, oh no. So that this is the kind of thing that, you know, I mentioned, like we ship a major update and then you're like, what did I do? What did I do? What did I mess up? And this case, I started getting to work immediately. And I was actually a little ways into the bus ride by the time I found this bug, but I ended up scrambling. I got the bug fixed, submitted to the App Store. I believe that it may have even gotten approved while I was on the bus somehow. I don't remember the details exactly, but anyway, I got the, I knew, and this kind of bug, you want to get it fixed as soon as possible because the more likelihood that a user has updated to the bug fix, the less likely, of course, they're going to run into the bug. So I got 4.0.3 out the door on the bus the day after I released 4.0.2. And I was sort of so busy. It's a combination of busy slash not wanting to make a big spectacle of it. I didn't want to go and like say, okay, it's always a little embarrassing when you're like, okay, here's my bug fix update. And then like 10 minutes later, you're like, here's my other bug fix update. But I just got it out there and I didn't update the blog. I didn't do anything. I didn't even mention it. It's funny, actually, yesterday I did get a couple emails from people who were like, hey, what's up? 4.0.2 here. I paid. And I was like, luckily I had everything in place. I could just say, okay, I'm sorry about this. All you have to do is update. Yeah. And that's fixed. And then anyway, this is kind of excruciating detail maybe, but like I had it in mind also, there's this couple other issues. So the kinds of things I fixed in 4.0.2, the whole strategy after releasing a major update is obviously anything that's like majorly screwed up. And luckily in Mars Edit 4, there wasn't anything majorly screwed up. The funny thing is that registration issue I described, I actually introduced in 4.0.2. So it was like one of these unfortunate things, just a side effect of something I did.
Yeah.
But for the most part, my focus since I launched 4, it has been all the little things that aren't major, but would nonetheless turn off new users. And like I said earlier, like one of the things you start thinking about after getting some attention is, okay, how many of these people now who I'm getting all this great attention, how many of these people are going to run into something that makes them say, well, this software sucks, and then just move on. And it's funny, I had some annoying bugs that are sort of consequences of my best intentions gone wrong. Like I embraced Apple's ATS. This is technology that lets you say the app can only connect to some servers over SSL. And, you know, in retrospect, I shouldn't have been so proactive about that. I think I was just thinking like, hey, this is easy for me to do. I made the assumption because WordPress, Blogger, Tumblr, and not to mention Red Sweater all support SSL. So I said, hey, here's the deal. Mars Edit's only going to communicate with those sites over SSL. Come to find out that some Tumblr sites actually require non-SSL. And this is just one of those things where it's like it's easy to make an assumption and then find out later you were wrong. So some Tumblr themes still require non-SSL.
Interesting.
So some Tumblr customers, even if, because I in the app, I actually proactively change the URL from HTTP to HTTPS if it's Tumblr. Nonetheless, it gets redirected to HTTP, and then it gets shut down by Apple's ATS system. So some subset of Tumblr users are, you know, typing their homepage into the app, and it just says, gives them this kind of cryptic message, like, you can't use HTTP. I'm like, oh, great. Anyway, that's one example. Bunch of bugs that are just like things that people have discovered. It's funny, actually, I inadvertently removed support for setting a quote-unquote main category on a movable type. And this is like, it's easy to inadvertently remove these things because, you know, movable type's the only thing that uses that I know of anymore.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of thing I wouldn't notice because you need a user who both uses movable type and depends on this main category feature. Right. So
small number.
Get these
of
little things that come up. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting about the SSL. I have a lot of work to do still on the SSL side with micro.blog in terms of hosted sites. It's still a little bit hit or miss whether everything is going to be SSL or not. You mentioned you get shut down by Apple's ATS. I just open that all up. You don't do that. You have it. How do you handle that for people that don't have SSL servers?
Well, that's the thing. I thought I was doing it pretty smart. I have the way you can specify those rules. You can say either everything's open or everything's closed, but then in either case, you can have a key for exception domains.
Okay.
And the exceptions are where you specify either more strict or less strict rules. And in my case, I have everything open, but then I have exception domains specifying that Tumblr, Blogger, Google, WordPress, these are all SSL required.
Okay.
And I was sort of thinking, like, I'm just going to try to be a good, I don't know, it's like trying to be as helpful as I can, And I don't really think it makes that big of a difference because it caused me a little bit more trouble than I wished because earlier on in like the beta tests, I also ran into the problem where, well, just because I say it has to be over SSL, that doesn't mean that like Apple doesn't automatically try the HTTPS version of a domain.
Right.
They just say, that didn't work, you're shut down. So I had these issues immediately where it was like, okay, people who had configured their blog in the past with an HTTP WordPress.com URL suddenly just wouldn't connect. And so I had to like add code to MarsEdit to automatically upgrade those. I have these special cases in MarsEdit now, like basically wherever it uses a URL from those domains, it has to like upgrade it. I'm a little annoyed, I guess, that I ended up doing this. And in the context of all the other stuff I was working on to get MarsEdit 4 out the door, it was a little bit of a lapse of judgment, I think, to allow myself to say, oh, well, this should be fine. Mm-hmm. I'll just turn this on.
Interesting.
And it's an example of sort of inviting disorder where, even if you don't think it's going to cause anything, sometimes it's better to just say, hey, am I going to get by? Am I going to be okay just leaving this thing completely open? Mm-hmm. Yes. The answer is yes. Like there's a reason Apple hasn't been more strict in shutting this down because they, I think, understand all these issues that people will run into.
It's just not practical in the real world. I think it's going to be years, if ever, where you can just say, oh, yeah, everything has to be SSL. It's a slow, slow process. This has been on my list a little bit to improve in micro.blog. I think I would like it to work is it always tries SSL, and if it doesn't work, then it falls back. So like, even if the user enters non-SSL, it tries SSL just to like help them.
Yeah.
And specifically, I think like if you enter your blog address, a lot of people are just like, for me, I might just enter manton.org and leave off the HTTP part. And I want the app to say, oh, well, let me try SSL. Let me try HTTPS. And if it redirects or fails, then fine. And I don't do all of that right now, but I think that's where I want my apps to be. Because I just want you to be able to type in your domain name and it do the right thing that's the most secure possible. And it's more work. Like you said, there's weird exceptions and you have code that probably says, if it's Tumblr, do this. If it's WordPress, do that. But I think it's probably better in the long run if the app can be a little smarter for the user.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I learned something interesting about this whole thing in the process. I learned that there's actually this like whole system. You might know about this, Manton, but there's this whole system for, I think it's called HSTS. Does that ring a bell?
Doesn't.
It's basically, it is a system whereby domains can advertise in their response headers that they, it stands for HTTP Strict Transport Security. And domains can advertise in their response headers that they affirm that they are not only do support HTTPS, but it basically gives like a time period during which they affirm that they will support HTTPS. So that it's a system for allowing clients to assume, like what you're saying, like to assume that a given domain name, a given URL can be requested with HTTPS without the user having necessarily specified it. And so when I was debugging this, I was scratching my head a little bit because it turned out, you know, I was like turning on strict connections to WordPress.com, for example. And then like my little test blog on WordPress.com, I discovered was like, it seemed to me sneaking past. It was like, it wasn't getting shut down. Because of course I wanted to test this. So I put HTTP, it was fine. And the reason was actually, Apple, to Apple's credit, they implement support for this at the system level where it's like if they have accessed an HTTPS site before, and I guess it's cached at a per app level, but for example, unbeknownst to me, because I had accessed my WordPress blog, CF Network had like cached away a little like bit of info so that every time I make a request with that HTTP URL, the system actually translates it for me.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so it's like kind of a cool system. And in fact, there's like preload lists. So like Apple has a bunch of, I think Apple has a bunch of domains for which it will just go ahead and do that. I don't know if it works for Apple itself or not, but it's kind of cool to know that that system's in place. And it's a good example of some, you know, some thinking that will make it more seamless for folks who adopt this in the future. I think for me, I shouldn't have been part of the bleeding edge on this, but I'm looking forward to it. You know, with your question about how to handle this on micro.blog, I imagine what you're thinking is, for example, using Let's Encrypt to give every user their own certificate.
That's part of it.
Crossed your mind?
And I do that now. I give everybody, I have a wildcard SSL cert, so by default, everybody like .micro.blog has SSL. And if you have a custom domain, so if you have yourname.com or whatever hosted on micro.blog, I have to enable it manually right now. Eventually it'll be automated, but yeah, I use Let's Encrypt. So I, like for all the people that are hosting a custom domain, I have Let's Encrypt, give them a certificate, and then I just renew those for people and they don't have to deal with it at all. So it's great, although I do have to enable it manually right now.
Yeah. I think that's really, you know, you said it's going to be a while until everything is HTTPS. I think Let's Encrypt obviously facilitates so much advancement in this area because you could imagine, for example, like Apache just having like a Let's Encrypt module that, I don't know, is on by default, you know? I don't think I'm missing anything. I think, well, I guess you have to put in information about the ID and stuff, but
Not much. I don't know if it can be completely automated at that level, but it's close because like to get an SSL cert, all you need to do is run one command line, give it your email address and your domain name. That's basically it, you know, and like where to put the certificate and all that kind of stuff. But like, it is pretty much magic. It is a huge, huge, huge step forward.
Yeah.
And it would be impossible for me to provide SSL for custom domains without it. Like, people would have to register their own thing and upload the cert somewhere. Like, it would be a nightmare. And now it's possible.
Right.
So it's pretty great because, like, I want people to have custom domains hosted on micro.blog. Yeah. So the fact that I can provide SSL is a really big deal.
Super cool. All right. Well, Manson, I should probably let you get back to working on your microblogging book.
Yeah. And likewise, good luck with Mars Edit 4.0.5 and 6 and I don't know. We'll follow
up. 6 and 7 all coming on the same day.
Yeah. Good luck. I'm glad things are going well. And thanks everyone for listening to the show. Of course, you can support the show as a member if you'd like. Go to corent.org, click on membership. And if you have any feedback, send it to feedback@corent.org or @corent on Twitter. Or we've got the Slack. It's chat.corent.org. You can join and talk about either the show with us or other Mac and iOS topics with other listeners.
And pizza.
And yeah, I ignore the pizza, too.